Chapter 4. I was not surprised to wake up alive. I suppose one is surprised only when one awakens dead. At any rate, I awoke with no more discomfort than a vague tingling in my extremities and lay there watching sunlight crawl across a rough plaster ceiling for a minute or more until an urgent thought shook me full awake. Wait a minute, wasn't I? Didn't they? I sat up and looked around. If there was any lingering sense that my execution had been a dream, the prosaic quality of my surroundings dispelled it immediately. The room was pie-shaped, with a curved and whitewashed outer stone wall and thick plaster ceilings. The bed was the only piece of furniture, and the heavy off-white linen on it complemented the texture of plaster and stone. There was a massive wooden door, closed, and an arched window open to the elements. One glance at the lapis sky beyond the window told me that I was still on Hyperion. There was no chance that I was still in the Port Romance prison. The stone here was too old, the details of the door too ornamental, the quality of the linen too good. I rose, found myself naked, and walked to the window. The autumn breeze was brisk, but the sun was warm on my skin. I was in a stone tower. Yellow chalma and the thick tangle of low weirwood wove a solid canopy of treetops up hills to the horizon. Everblues grew on granite rock faces. I could see other walls, ramparts, and the curve of another tower stretching away along the ridgeline upon which this tower stood. The walls seemed old. The quality of their construction and the organic feel of their architecture was from an era of skill and taste long predating the fall. I guessed at once where I must be. The chalma and weirwood suggested that I was still on the southern continent of Aquila. The elegant runes spoke of the abandoned city of Endymion. I had never been to the town from which my family took its surname. But I had heard many descriptions of it from Grandam, our clan storyteller. Endymion had been one of the first Hyperion cities settled after the dropship crash almost 700 years earlier. Until the fall, it had been famous for its fine university, a huge castle-like structure that towered over the old town below it. Grandam's great-grandfather's grandfather had been a professor at the university until the Pax troops commandeered the entire region of central Aquila and literally sent thousands of people packing. And now, I had returned. A bald man with blue skin and cobalt blue eyes came through the door, set underwear in a simple day suit of what looked like homespun cotton on the bed, and said, "Please get dressed." I admit that I stared silently as the man turned and went out the door. Blue skin, bright blue eyes, no hair. It had to be the first android that I had ever seen. If asked, I would have said that there were no androids left on Hyperion. They had been illegal to biofacture since before the fall. And although they had been imported by the legendary Sad King Billy to build most of the cities in the north centuries ago, I had never heard of one still existing on our world. I shook my head and got dressed. The day suit fit nicely, despite my rather unusually large shoulders and long legs. I was back at the window when the android returned. He stood by the open door and gestured with an open hand. "This way, please, M. Endymion." I resisted the impulse to ask questions and followed him up the tower stairs. The room at the top took up the entire floor. Late afternoon sunlight streamed in through yellow and red stained glass windows. At least one window was open, and I could hear the rustle of the leaf canopy far below as a wind came up from the valley. This room was as white and bare as my cell had been, except for a cluster of medical equipment and communications consoles in the center of the circle. The android left, closing the heavy door behind him. and it took me a second to realize that there was a human being in the locus of all that equipment. At least I thought it was a human being. The man was lying on a flow foam hover chair bed that had been adjusted to a sitting position. Tubes, IV drips, monitor filaments, and organic-looking umbilicals ran from the equipment to the wizened figure in the chair. I say wizened, but in truth, the man's body looked almost mummified, the skin wrinkled like the folds of an old leather jacket, the skull mottled and almost perfectly bald, the arms and legs emaciated to the point of being vestigial appendages. Everything about the old man's posture made me think of a wrinkled and featherless baby bird that had fallen out of the nest. His parchment skin had a blue cast to it that made me think android for a moment. But then I saw the different shade of blue, the faint glow of the palms, ribs, and forehead, and realized that I was looking at a real human who had enjoyed, or suffered, centuries of Poulsen treatments. No one receives Poulsen treatments anymore. The technology was lost in the fall, as were the raw materials from worlds lost in time and space. Or so I thought. But here was a creature at least many centuries old who must have received Poulsen treatments as recently as decades ago. The old man opened his eyes. I have seen eyes with as much power as his. But nothing in my life to that point had prepared me for the intensity of such a gaze. I think I took a step back.
"Come closer, Roland Imian."
The voice was like the scraping of a dull blade on parchment. The old man's mouth moved like a turtle's beak. I stepped closer, stopping only when a comm console stood between me and the mummified form. The old man blinked and lifted a bony hand that still seemed too heavy for the twig of a wrist.
"Do you know who I am?"
The scratch of a voice was as soft as a whisper. I shook my head.
"Do you know where you are?"
I took a breath. "Endymion. The abandoned university, I think." The wrinkles folded back in a toothless smile.
"Very good. The namesake recognizes the heaps of stone which named his family. But do you not know who I might be?"
"No."
"And you have no questions about how you survived your execution?"
I stood at parade rest and waited. The old man smiled again.
"Very good indeed. All things come to him who waits. And the details are not that enlightening. Bribes in high places. A stunner substituted for the death wand. More bribes to those who certify the death and dispose of the body. It's not the how we are interested in, is it, Roland Imian?"
"No," I said at last. "Why?" The turtle's beak twitched. The massive head nodded. I noticed now that even through the damage of centuries, the face was still sharp and angular, a satyr's countenance.
"Precisely," he said. "Why? Why go to the trouble of faking your execution and transporting your fucking carcass across half a fucking continent? Why indeed?"
The obscenities did not seem especially harsh from the old man's mouth. It was as if he had sprinkled his speech with them for so long that they deserved no special emphasis. I waited.
"I want you to run an errand for me, Roland Imian."
The old man's breath wheezed. Pale fluid flowed through the intravenous tubes.
"Do I have a choice?"
The face smiled again. But the eyes were as unchanging as the stone in the walls.
"We always have choices, dear boy. In this case, you can ignore any debt you might owe me for saving your life, and simply leave here. Walk away. My servants will not stop you. With luck, you will get out of this restricted area, find your way back to more civilized regions, and avoid PAX patrols, where your identity and lack of papers might be, embarrassing.
I nodded. My clothes, chronometer, work papers, and PAX ID were probably in Toschahi Bay by now. Working as a hunting guide in the fens made me forget how often the authorities checked IDs in the cities. I would soon be reminded if I wandered back to any of the coastal cities or inland towns.
And even rural jobs, such as shepherd and guide, required PAX ID for tax and tithe forms,
which left hiding in the interior for the rest of my life, living off the land and avoiding people.
"Or," said the old man, "you can run an errand for me and become rich."
He paused, his dark eyes inspecting me the way I had seen professional hunters inspect pups that might or might not prove to be good hunting dogs.
"Tell me," I said.
The old man closed his eyes and rattled in a deep breath. He did not bother to open his eyes when he spoke.
"Can you read, Roland Dimion?"
"Yes."
"Have you read the poem known as the Cantos?"
"No."
"But you have heard some of it? Surely being born into one of the nomadic shepherd clans of the north, the storyteller has touched on the Cantos."
There was a strange tone in the cracked voice, modesty perhaps. I shrugged.
"I've heard bits of it.
My clan preferred the Garden Epic or the Glennon Height Saga." The satyr features creased into a smile.
"The Garden Epic, yes? Rall was a centaur hero in that, was he not?"
I said nothing. Grandam had loved the character of the centaur named Rall. My mother and I both had grown up listening to tales of him.
"Do you believe the stories?"
snapped the old man.
"The Cantos tales, I mean."
"Believe them?" I said. "That they actually happened that way? The pilgrims and the shrike and all that?" I paused a minute. There were those who believed all the tall tales told in the Cantos. And there were those who believed none of it, that it was all myth and maundering thrown together to add mystery to the ugly war and confusion that was the fall.
"I never really thought about it," I said truthfully. "Does it matter?"
The old man seemed to be choking, but then I realized that the dry, rattling sounds were chuckles.
"Not really," he said at last. "Now listen. I will tell you the outline of the errand. It takes energy for me to speak, so save your questions for when I am finished."
He blinked and gestured with his mottled claw toward the chair covered with a white sheet.
"Do you wish to sit?"
I shook my head and remained at parade rest.
"All right," said the old man. "My story begins almost 270-some years ago during the fall. One of the pilgrims in the Cantos was a friend of mine. Her name was Braunlamia. She was real. After the fall, after the death of the hegemony and the opening of the time tombs, Braunlamia gave birth to a daughter. The child's name was Diana, but the little girl was headstrong and changed her name almost as soon as she was old enough to talk. For a while she was known as Cynthia, then Kate, short for Hecate. And then, when she turned 12, she insisted that her friends and family call her Temis. When I last saw her, she was called Ania."
I heard the name as Ania. The old man stopped and squinted at me.
"You think this is not important, but names are important. If you had not been named after this city, which was in turn named after an ancient poem, then you would not have come to my attention, and you could not be here today. You would be dead, feeding the skarkworms in the Great South Sea. Do you understand, Rolandimian?
No, I said. He shook his head.
It does not matter. Where was I?
The last time you saw the child, she called herself Anea.
Yes.
The old man closed his eyes again.
She was not an especially attractive child, but she was unique. Everyone who knew her felt that she was different, special, not spoiled despite all the nonsense with the name changes, just different.
He smiled, showing pink gums.
Have you ever met someone who is profoundly different, Rolandimian?
I hesitated only a second.
No, I said.
It was not quite true. This old man was different. But I knew he was not asking that.
Kate. Anea. Was different, he said.
Eyes closed again.
Her mother knew it. Of course, Braun knew that the child was special before she was born.
He stopped and opened his eyes enough to squint at me.
You've heard this part of the Kantos?
Yes, I said.
It was foretold by a cybrid entity that the woman named Lamia was to give birth to a child known as the One Who Teaches. I thought that the old man was going to spit. A stupid title. No one called Anea that during the time I knew her. She was simply a child, brilliant and headstrong, but a child. Everything that was unique only in potential, but then...
His voice trailed off, and his eyes seemed to film over. It was as if he had lost track of the conversation. I waited.
But then Braun Lamia died,
he said several minutes later, voice stronger, as if there had been no gap in the monologue.
And Anea disappeared. She was 12. Technically, I was her guardian, but she did not ask my permission to disappear. One day she left and I never heard from her again.
Here the story paused again, as if the old man were a machine that ran down occasionally and required some internal rewinding.
Where was I?
He said at last.
You never heard from her again. Yes. I never heard from her. But I knew where she went and when she will reappear. The time tombs are off limits now, guarded from public view by the Pack's troops stationed there. But do you remember the names and functions of the tombs, Rolandimian?
I grunted. Grandam used to grill me on aspects of the oral tales in much this way. I used to think that Grandam was old. Next to this ancient, wizened thing, Grandam had been an infant.
I think I remember the tombs, I said. There was the one called the Sphinx, the Jade Tomb, the Obelisk, the Crystal Monolith where the soldier was buried. Colonel Fedmon Kassad, muttered the old man.
Then his gaze returned to me.
Go on. The three cave tombs, only the third cave tomb led anywhere, interrupted the old man again. To labyrinths on other worlds. The Pack sealed it. Go on.
That's all I can remember. Oh, the Shrike Palace. The old man showed a turtle's sharp smile.
One mustn't forget the Shrike Palace, or our old friend the Shrike must one. Is that all of them?
I think so, I said. Yes. The mummified figure nodded.
Braun Lamia's daughter disappeared through one of these tombs. Can you guess which one?
No. I did not know, but I suspected.
7 days after Braun died, the girl left a note, went to the Sphinx in the dead of night, and disappeared. Do you remember where the Sphinx led, boy?
According to the Kantos, I said, Saul Weintraub and his daughter traveled to the distant future through the Sphinx.
Yes, whispered the ancient thing in the hoverbed. Saul and Rachel and a precious few others disappeared into the Sphinx
before the pack sealed it and closed off the valley of the time tombs. Many tried in those early days, tried to find a shortcut to the future. But the Sphinx seemed to choose who might travel its tunnel through time. And it accepted the girl, I said. The old man merely grunted at this statement of the obvious.
Roland Dimion,
he rasped at last. Do you know what I am going to ask of you?
No,
I said, although once again I had a strong suspicion.
I want you to go after my Aenea, said the old man. I want you to find her, to protect her from the packs, to flee with her, and when she has grown up and become what she must become, to give her a message. I want you to tell her that her Uncle Martin is dying, and that if she wishes to speak to him again, she must come home.
I tried not to sigh. I'd guessed that this ancient thing had once been the poet, Martin Silenus. Everyone knew the Kantos and its author. How he had escaped the pack's purges and been allowed to live in this restricted place was a mystery, but one I did not choose to explore. You want me to go north to the continent of Equus, fight my way past several thousand Pax troops, somehow get into the Valley of the Time Tombs, get into the Sphinx, hope it accepts me, then chase this child into the distant future, hang around with her for a few decades, and then tell her to go back in time to visit you? For a moment there was a silence broken only by the soft sounds of Martin Silenus's life support equipment. The machines were breathing.
Not exactly, he said at last.
I waited.
She has not traveled to some distant future, said the old man. At least not distant from us now. When she stepped through the entrance of the Sphinx 247 years ago, it was for a short trip through time. 262 Hyperion years, to be exact.
How do you know this? I asked. From everything I had read, no one, not even the pack scientists, who had had 2 centuries to study the sealed tombs, had been able to predict how far into the future the Sphinx would send someone.
I know it, said the ancient poet. Do you doubt me?
Instead of responding to that, I said, so the child, Aenea, will step out of the Sphinx sometime this year.
She will step out of the Sphinx in 42 hours, 16 minutes, said the old satyr.
I admit that I blinked.
And the packs will be waiting for her, he continued. They also know to the minute when she will emerge.
I did not ask how they came by the information.
And capturing Aenea is the single most important thing on the packs' agenda,
rasped the old poet.
They know that the future of the universe depends upon this.
I knew now that the old poet was senile. The future of the universe depended upon no single event, that I knew. I held my silence.
There are, at this moment, more than 30,000 Pax troops in and around the Valley of the Time Tombs. At least 5,000 of them are Vatican Swiss Guard.
I whistled at this. The Vatican Swiss Guard was the elite of the elite, the best-trained, best-equipped military force in the far-flung expanse of the Pax. 12 Vatican Guard troops in full regalia could have beaten the entire 10,000 troops of Hyperion's home guard. So, I said, I have 42 hours to get to Equus, cross the Sea of Grass and the mountains, somehow get past 20 or 30,000 of the Pax's best troops, and rescue the girl?
Yes, said the ancient figure in the bed.
I managed not to roll my eyes.
What then? I said.
There is nowhere we can hide. The Pax controls all of Hyperion, all spacecraft, the space lanes, and every world of what used to be the hegemony. If she is as important as you say, they will turn Hyperion upside down until they find her, even if we could somehow get off-planet, which we can't.
There would be no way we could escape.
There is a way for you to get off planet, the poet said in a tired voice. There is a ship.
I swallowed hard. There is a ship. The idea of traveling between the stars for months while decades or years passed back home took my breath away. I had joined the home guard with a childish notion of someday belonging to the Pax military and flying between the stars, a foolish notion for a youngster who had already decided not to accept the cruciform. Still, I said, not truly believing that there was a ship. No member of the Pax Mercantilis would transport fugitives. Even if we make it to another world, they would have us, unless you see us fleeing by ship for centuries of time debt.
No, said the old man, not centuries, not decades. You will escape by ship to one of the nearest worlds of the old hegemony. Then you will go a secret way. You will see the old worlds. You will travel the river Tethys.
I knew now that the old man had lost his reason. When the Farcasters fell and the AI Technocore abandoned humankind, the world web and hegemony had died that same day. The tyranny of interstellar distances had been reimposed upon humanity. Now only the Pax forces, their puppet Mercantilis, and the hated ousters braved the darkness between the stars.
Come, rasped the old man.
His fingers would not uncurl as he gestured me closer. I leaned over the low comm console. I could smell him. A vague combination of medicine, age, and something like leather. I did not need the memories of Grandam's campfire tales to explain the river Tethys, and to know why I now knew that the old man was far gone into senility. Everyone knew about the river Tethys. It and the so-called Grand Concourse had been two constant Farcaster avenues between the hegemony worlds. The Concourse had been a street connecting 100-some worlds under 100-some suns, its broad avenue open to everyone and stitched together by Farcaster portals that never closed. The river Tethys had been a less traveled route, but still important for bulk commerce and the countless pleasure boats that had floated effortlessly from world to world on the single highway of water. The concourse had been sliced into 1,000 separate segments by the fall of the World Web Farcaster Network. The Tethys had simply ceased to exist. The connecting portals useless, the single river on 100 worlds reverted to 100 smaller rivers that would never be connected again. Even the old poet seated before me had described the river's death. I remembered the words from Grandam's recitation of the cantos. And the river that had flowed on for 2 centuries or more, linked through space and time by the tricks of the Technocore, ceased flowing now on Fuji and on Barnard's world, on Actaeon and Deneb Dre, on Esperance and Nevermore, everywhere the Tethys ran, like ribbons through the worlds of man. There the portals worked no more. There the riverbeds ran dry. There the currents ceased to swirl. Lost were the tricks of Technocore. Lost were the travelers forevermore. Locked the portal, locked the door. Flowed the Tethys nevermore.
Come closer, whispered the old poet, still beckoning me with his yellowed finger.
I leaned closer. The ancient creature's breath was like a dry wind out of an unsealed tomb, free of odor but ancient, somehow redolent of forgotten centuries, as he whispered to me.
A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness.
I pulled my head back and nodded, as if the old man had said something sensible. It was clear that he was mad. As if reading my mind, the old poet chuckled.
I have often been called insane by those who underestimate the power of poetry.
Do not decide now, Roland Imian. We will meet later for dinner, and I will finish describing your challenge. Decide then. For now, rest. Your death and resurrection must have tired you.
The old man hunched over, and there came the dry rattling that I now understood as laughter. The android showed me back to my room. I caught glimpses of courtyards and outbuildings through the tower windows. Once I saw another android, also male, walking past clerestory windows across the courtyard. My guide opened the door and stepped back. I realized that I would not be locked in, that I was not a prisoner.
"Evening clothes have been set out for you, sir," said the blue-skinned man. "You are, of course, free to go and wander the old university grounds as you wish. I should warn you, M. Endymion, that there are dangerous animals in the forest and mountains in this vicinity."
I nodded and smiled. Dangerous animals would not keep me from leaving if I wished to leave. At the moment, I did not. The android turned to leave then, and on impulse I stepped forward and did something that would change the course of my life forever. "Wait," I said. I extended a hand. "We haven't been introduced. I'm Roland Imian." For a long moment the android only looked at my extended hand, and I was sure that I had committed some breach of protocol. Androids had been, after all, considered something less than human centuries ago, when they had been biofactured for use during the Hegira expansion. Then the artificial man grasped my hand in his and shook firmly.
"I am A. Betic," he said softly. "It is a pleasure to make your acquaintance."
A. Betic. The name had some resonance for me that I could not place. I said, "I would like to talk to you, A. Betic. Learn more about you and this place and the old poet." The android's blue eyes lifted, and I thought I glimpsed something like amusement there.
"Yes, sir," he said. "I would be happy to speak with you. I fear that it must be later, since there are many duties I have to oversee at this moment."
"Later, then," I said, and stepped back. "I look forward to it." A. Betic nodded and descended the tower stairs. I walked into my room. Except for the bed being made and a suit of elegant evening clothes laid out there, the space was just as it had been. I went to the window and looked out over the ruins of Endymion University. Tall everblues rustled in the cool breeze. Violet leaves tumbled from the weirwood stand near the tower and scraped across the flagstone pavement 20 meters below. Chalma leaves scented the air with their distinctive cinnamon. I had grown up only a few hundred kilometers northeast on the Aquila Moors between these mountains and the rugged area known as the Beak. But the chill freshness of the mountain air here was new to me. The sky seemed a deeper lapis than any I had seen from the moors or lowlands. I breathed in the autumn air and grinned. Whatever strangeness lay ahead, I was damned glad to be alive. Leaving the window, I headed for the tower stairs and a look around the university and city after which my family had taken its name. However crazy the old man was, dinner conversation should be interesting. Suddenly, when I was almost at the base of the tower stairs, I stopped in my tracks. A. Betic. The name was from Grandam's telling of the Kantos. A. Betic was the android who piloted the pilgrim's levitation barge Benares, northeast from the city of Keats on the continent of Equus, up the Hooghly River, past Naiad River Station, the Carla Locks, and Dukobor's Copse to where the navigable river ended in Edge. From Edge, the pilgrims had gone on alone across the Sea of Grass. I remembered listening as a child, wondering why A. Betic was the only android named, and wondering what had happened to him when the pilgrims left him behind at Edge. The name had been lost to me for more than 2 decades. Shaking my head slightly, wondering whether it was the old poet or I who was mad, I went out into the late afternoon light to explore Endymion.